So I think this is a bit of a pep talk for all of us who are doing alternative computing in open source. And I thought a nice talk for this group might be to just look at some things that are still inspirational today. I'm not here in person because I have a real immune problem to respiratory diseases. My doctor has forbidden me from taking airplane flights as much as possible, particularly international ones. So we're doing this with Polycom. And the last couple of talks I've given, I've been able to run the talk from California here. But when we tested this out yesterday, we couldn't quite get the packets all the way through. Maybe they're held up in Dublin customs somewhere. So instead we're going to use this idea that's been talked about a lot, which is an intelligent agent. Mike Ruger is the intelligent agent, so he's going to go to the next slide. And I'd spent 5 years being a systems programmer on big computers of the day in the early 60s, and I'd really not thought about direct interaction with computing until I went to graduate school in 66. And first thing I was shown was a system that was only 3 years old at that time, Ivan Sutherland's Sketchpad. And if Mike clicks on that picture there, we can see a video of what Sketchpad looked like in 62, 63. This is on a huge computer the size of the room you're in. And we can see why it's called Sketchpad in a second, because he drew those lines casually, and now he's pointing to them, and he's saying to the system, now make all of those lines mutually perpendicular. And you saw Sketchpad solve that problem. You see it has the first clipping window, and the drawing pad he's working on in this very first graphic system. Now you see he says, make these parallel to each other. Now he's going to use them as the... So he's drawn a little rivet here, and he just showed you a solution. Now he's showing you another solution when he says straighten it up. The drawing virtual page is about a third of a mile on a side in Sketchpad, so it was a kind of a first zooming interface. And that was a master drawing of a rivet, so now what he's going to do is get an instance of that rivet. He can rotate it and move it, change its size. I think I was just saying before I got cut off that Ivan had to do all of the line drawing routines himself, because this display just plotted points. It was on a very large machine the size of the room that you're in. Now he's showing you he can make other instances of that master drawing. Now he realizes, whoops, that cross piece is in there. So he goes to the master, tells those guys to become transparent, and we can see that the instances have felt that change. So this is pretty much the first object-oriented software system that I know of. And he can also make any new drawing he made, like this flange with a rivet in it, a master. And now we can make instances of these. Sketchpad could solve nonlinear problems. So if you drew a bridge in... Okay. So if you drew a bridge in Sketchpad and put the spring constants on the beams and told it to solve the problem, it could figure out the stresses and strains on the bridge. It could do electric circuits, not knowing anything about them beforehand. Now, once I asked Ivan, how is it possible for you to have, in just 1 year for your PhD thesis, to have invented computer graphics, done the first object-oriented software system and then one of the first real-time problem solvers all in 1 year by yourself in machine code. And Ivan looked at me and said, well, I didn't know it was hard. So if you want the closest thing our field has ever had to a Newton, this is it, because the sensibilities of the field in this area before Ivan did this and the sensibilities of the field after he did this were one of the largest jumps in computing science. So hit the next button there, Mike. And the other thing was in the air at Utah, which is one of the ARPA projects. ARPA funded Ivan and many other places, MIT Project Mac, was this project to do a worldwide network with the same connectivity roughly as the power grid. So next. And about the same time, a couple of Norwegians started thinking about doing what we now call objects in a programming language. And the next thing was that my background was in both biology and mathematics, and seeing all of these things together started me thinking about biological systems and a kind of an abstract. Oh, just tap on Ivan to get rid of, there you go. And sort of this abstraction of lots and lots of things connected by messages. And next, get this notion of a dynamic abstraction for all the hardware and all the software that we're going to build in the next 20 or 30 years. Okay, go to the next slide. So the next thing I saw when I was in graduate school was Doug Engelbart stuff. And yeah, go ahead and play that first movie there, Mike. So this picture here could have been taken yesterday, but it was actually taken, I think, in 1966, of Doug in front of the first black-on-white display with his mouse.
I'd like for produce to get big. I'd like to say one branch only, and let me look just down there when I see it. Oh, I can say I'd like to see one line only. I can see. But there's another thing I can do. There's a root I said I'd have here. So here, I'm afraid I'll need a different picture of the view. So here's what I drew with a picture drawing capability. Here's a slide map if I start from work. And here's the route I seem to have to go to pick up all the materials. And that's my plan for getting home tonight. But if I want to, I can say, the library, what am I supposed to pick up there? I can just point to that. And oh, I see, overdue books and all. Well, there was a statement there with that name on it. Go back. What am I supposed to pick up at the drugstore? I see, very sick. All right. Margaret can do things if I want to. Just say, I'd like to interchange produce and canned materials. Bingo. And they're all numbered right if I care to look. Interchanging them very quickly. Cans are going to get interchanged with produce. Do it and all
that's renumbered. Okay, so one thing to notice there was that the response was quicker than we're used to today. It was actually sub-second response, and in fact that two-handed interface that they had was designed so you could do all navigation and all inputs with your hands out to the side. And give as many as three commands a second, then the system was set up for sub-second response. Just to give you a sense of what this computer was a half MIP machine with 192K, and it was a 20-user time-sharing system. The time-sharing system was actually designed by Butler Lamson and Peter Deutsch. It was very, very efficient. And the Engelbart programmers absolutely wanted to have sub-second response, and they got it because they actually knew how to program, and that was the standard to which they were working. So the other thing that, so this is what we know Engelbart for, which is basically the invention of the mouse and the hyperlinking and so forth, but his conceptions are much, much grander. In fact, I was just talking to him on the phone yesterday about what the world has understood of his stuff and what it hasn't understood. And his notion was that if you're going to do something on a computer for adults, you really have to deal with the problem of augmenting the collective IQ of groups of people working together. It's not a question just of providing access to information, but you have to be able to deal with intertwined information strands, and you have to be able to do immersive collaboration. And you can see them having a meeting up there. They're actually all collaborating in the same system. They have multiple mouse pointers and stuff. And if Mike plays the second movie, you'll get a sense of what could, all, by the way, all of these demos came from the big demo that Engelbart gave 35 years ago now in 1968 to 3,000 people in San Francisco. So play that second movie, Mike.
Set it up so I see it over like that. It leaves a corner up there, and I say, now, computer, do the automatic switching that will bring in a camera picture from the camera mounted on his console, such as the camera mounted on mine is. Hi, Bill. That's great. Now we're connected audio. You can see my words. You can point at it, and I can see your face, and we can talk. So let's do some collaborating.
Pull off to a directive file and see what the directive is to get Roman numeral page numbers. I'm into the file now. Here's the first level of the hierarchy. Let's open up page formatting. Look, we want page numbering, so we'll open that up. We find, yes, here it is, Roman numerals. We find out the directive. Yep, your bug's right on it already, Doug. Here's the directive we want. So we work down quite a way into a hierarchy, as you can see.
So I'll tell you what was going on there, was that Bill Paxton was about 50 miles away. He was down in Menlo Park, where the time-sharing system was, and Engelbart was up in San Francisco, and they were doing telemetry back then over a jury-rigged network that they made. They also had a connection to a programming group up in Oregon, and in between offices and in this demo, they would also pipe video along so that you could be immersive and share the various, I'm not sure what happened there, but I think you get the idea. So Bill was demonstrating to Doug in this shared space some stuff that they were trying to find out together. So let's go to the next slide. So again, it's the same time the mouse was invented is when the tablet was invented, first good one in 64. And the conception here was of a very intimate user interface where the tablet was not used for tapping as it is today in PDAs.
Move the connector out of the way so that we may draw a box in its place.
So it recognizes the box.
The printing in the box is being used as commentary only in this case. The box is slightly too large, so we may change its size. Then draw a flow from the connector to the box. Attach a decision element to the box and draw a flow from it to scan. We then erase the flow arrows attached to the process post new area and move the box to a new position. This allows us to draw a new box.
Okay, so the comments on that are that it's surprising, given the incredible computing power of today's PDAs, that we see, I don't know of any systems that use the fact that you can recognize shapes and strokes to actually allow people to build something of interest. So the conception in today's computers for the use of pen-based systems is really rudimentary. The demo that Microsoft shipped with the HP tablet computer had none of these elements in it. So there's a whole set of wonderful stuff here for expert, fluent use of computing that is seems to have been almost lost. But it's something that basically is in our future if we want it. So go to the next slide. So these systems influenced me, and a friend of mine, Ed Cheadle, and I built this machine. This is a picture of it on its own display, so you can see what a desktop computer looked like in the 67 to 69 era. It had a tablet. It had multiple windows, not overlapping windows, because this was still a calligraphic display. Sounded like a 747 taking off. Had about 700 dual inline packages inside this thing and generated an enormous amount of heat. But it had many of the elements that we're interested in personal computing pretty early on. In 68, I went around visiting people who were doing end-user computing, and I stumbled on Seymour Papert. And Papert had been working with children to do end-user computing, and he found that if you got a child to close his eyes and move his body in a circle, the child could articulate that a circle was going a little, turning a little over and over again. In a logo, that's repeat, forward five, turn five. And so if you execute that little program there, you get this perfect circle, because the six-year-old actually understands differential geometry with his body. So the six-year-old is always the center of his own coordinate system and does everything incrementally from that moving center of the universe, and that's Gaussian differential vector geometry. Seymour Papert is a mathematician and realized that you could take advanced mathematics and make it into children's toys. So that had a huge effect on my sensibilities, because it seemed like it might be much more fruitful to design for children, because the children haven't learned all the ways you shouldn't do things yet. So, next slide. So that led to this idea of, first I drew the cartoon in the upper left-hand corner of a couple of kids making Space War and playing them on their little kiddie computers connected with a wireless network that ARPA was working on at the time. And then I made the cardboard model and started thinking of this as being like a musical instrument. I had been a professional musician before I went to graduate school, and professional, musicians do not think of their musical instruments as machines. We still call computers machines, and the reason is we don't have an intimate enough relationship with them yet. So I thought of this computer that would happen sometime in the future as an instrument whose music was ideas. Next slide. And finally, around this time, I finally understood what Lisp was. And I'd known sort of the surface form of it, just a language with a lot of parentheses. But partly because of this interest in interactive computing, I got interested in the PDP-1 interactive Lisp that Peter Deutsch did when he was only 16 years old, which is really an incredible feat of programming. And it was based on this lower half page of page 13 in the Lisp 1.5 manual, which is kind of the Maxwell's equations of programming languages. And I finally spent that a couple of hours on a Sunday afternoon to trace through this program and understand it, and I realized that this was a completely different, incredibly powerful approach to thinking about all forms of programming systems, not just from the standpoint of expression, but from the standpoint of late binding. And I realized that the programming, the object system I had done for the Flex machine was not late bound enough. So next slide. And as Jim mentioned, at Xerox PARC, we got a chance to do all kinds of things. If you click on that thing in the upper left-hand corner there, Mike. So at Xerox PARC, here is the cardboard model of the Dynabook, and I'd just gotten an HP 35. It's cost $700 back then. And the two interesting stories of this HP 35 were, as I was flying on an airplane, the pilot had just said we were at 39,000 feet. The passenger next to me looked out the window and said, "I wonder how far the horizon is." And without thinking about it, I took the HP 35 out, calculated the distance to the center of the Earth in feet, added 39,000 to it, and did the triangle to find out that the horizon was about 240 miles away, and it was all done automatically without thinking about it on an airplane, and my reaction to that was, holy shit. The second story about this HP 35 was that about 2.5 weeks after I bought it, somebody stole it. And I was really dismayed about this until I realized, wow, somebody's finally made a computer small enough to be stolen. So next slide, please. So this happens to be the 30th anniversary of the Xerox PARC Alto, mainly done by Chuck Thacker in only 3.5 months. And the system we put on it was the first version of Smalltalk, which happened in imitation of the lower half of page 13 in the List 1.5 manual. So I spent a couple of weeks figuring out sort of a similar kind of meta program, but one that would work for objects and one that wasn't recursive. And that's it on the left-hand side there. And then Dan Ingalls made it into a real thing, and all of a sudden we had a very powerful object system, which ran as soon as the Alto started running. And I'll just show you one little interesting clip, the one at the top right there, Mike. So the Alto is making the sound. Two and a half, actually. But look at the animation. All for kids. And here's a 15-year-old boy's end-user program of a little circuit diagram drawing system. He actually did this for his own use. Kind of what we're interested in is children making tools for themselves. So a couple of commentaries there. The Alto was a double-level microcoded system, so it's hard to compare it against current-day systems, which are basically single-level machines with caches. The microcode cycle time was about maybe 150 nanoseconds, so it was perhaps a 6 MIPS machine or six something about a 15 megahertz clock. But if you notice the animation there, it completely beats the shit out of any 400 megahertz PDA I know of. And the reason was is that we knew we wanted to do really good multiple plane animation, and the people who do PDAs don't know what they want to do with them. So the differences there are huge, and Chuck Thacker and Butler Lampson estimate that approximately a factor of 1,000 in efficiency has been lost since the Alto. That's an interesting thing to contemplate, because even though Moore's Law, you know, Nicholas Negroponte likes to say that Andy giveth, but Bill taketh away. But in fact, this factor of 1,000 in efficiency that's been lost is quite a few turns of Moore's Law. And so this is not a good thing. In fact, one of the last benchmarks we did in 1979 at Xerox PARC on the machine that we were using then, when compared to the computers of today, 1 gigahertz computers of today, was only a factor of 50 slower. And one would expect to get about a factor of 30,000 from Moore's Law faster. So that difference is about a factor of 600, which is in line with the Thacker and Lampson estimates. So apparently what's going on is that although Moore's Law is going faster and faster, we're getting more and more machine resources, both the processor architectures and the software architectures and practices are deteriorating. So you can get a 400 megahertz X-scale PDA today that can hardly do anything. So I think this is a serious problem, and I think this is one of the things that the open source community really has to address. Let's go on to the next slide. I mean, I personally would like to have an Alto in a PDA. So here's something that Xerox PARC brought to the party. We didn't actually invent the GUI. There are plenty of GUIs in the 60s, and some of them are really fabulous. I've been showing you a couple of them. And we didn't invent Windows. The Windows were already, one window was in Sketchpad, and multiple windows were in Sketchpad 3, and we had multiple windows on the Flex machine, and so windows were around. We did invent the overlapping windows, because that was something that was a very natural thing to do if you had the first bitmap display, which we did. But here's something I think that we can claim to have done, and that is to change, at least during the PARC years, to change the sensibility of what a user interface is. Because even the GUIs in the 60s were basically software versions of nuclear reactor control panels. That is, the basic theory of any interface by most programmers back then was it was supposed to be about access to function. And because of that, most of these interfaces required training. And partly because we were thinking about children, but also we were thinking about end users at PARC, we tried to make interfaces that were actually learnable, that had that were learning environments, explorable environments. Maybe the first few years of the Macintosh reflected that. But if you look at most of the user interfaces today, they've deteriorated back into the nuclear reactor control panel things. And the irony is that the original easy to learn user interface now requires more training than ever. And not just in Windows machines, but also in Linux-based systems and also on the Mac. Basically a general deterioration of sensibility by the people who do it. It's basically instrumental reasoning, which is doing things only because they contribute to some goal, and leaving the problems of learning to somebody else. Next slide. And here's kind of the park-eye view of what happened starting in the early 80s, was the world got gray, was going along pretty well, and then all the manufacturers started devoting their efforts to trying to sell systems into business. And the problem with business is it's quite boring. People don't really want to do anything with computers except to automate grudgingly stuff that they've already been doing for 200 years. So I think this is one of the greatest contributions of this general retrograde process that's been going on for the last 20 years. Next slide. And this has happened before. So in the 1400s, there were really expensive manuscript books costing the equivalent of millions of dollars. And next. Then Gutenberg came out and imitated the Bibles, and even had people to hand, even though these Bibles were a lot cheaper, they're only $60,000 in today's money, 3 years of a clerk's wages. They had people come in and hand illuminate them so people wouldn't be frightened by them. So they look like the books of the past, big, big, heavy books. And then 50 years later, you can think of those as kind of desktop computers, the Gutenberg Bibles, because they look like time-sharing terminals. Nobody knew what they should look like. 50 years later, Aldus made little portable books that were the size of saddlebags. That's the size book that we generally have today, is the size of saddlebags. And then there's this big gap, lots of religious wars and use of the printing press. But in fact, the real printing revolution didn't happen until about 150 years after the invention of the press, because many generations of children had to grow up in this gradual realization of what the printed book was actually good for, which turned out to be new kinds of political argument and new kinds of argument about the world that we live in. So both science and the revolution in politics, which we still enjoy today, happened many, many decades after. So these great ideas, and this isn't because people in the 16th century, like Aldus and Erasmus, didn't understand what the book was good for. The problem was that virtually no one else did. And so it took a long, long time for people to start getting fluent in reading and writing and arguing to catch up with what Aldus and Erasmus already knew. Okay. Then when computers happen, there's a kind of a similar thing. In 1950, go ahead, Mike. 1950, mainframes are kind of the multi-million dollar institutionally owned things. And then we did desktop computers. Go ahead. And had this idea of the portable thing that you could put in a saddlebag. But in fact, what's happening right now is something very similar. There's this gap between all these dreams, which I think were mostly good dreams. So I think Engelbart's dream is a really good dream. Sutherland's dream of what you should be able to do with computer graphics, and the people at RAND's dream about what you should do with pendant-based systems, I think these are great dreams. I think we should be able to have really wonderful computers for children by now. But next, I believe we're still in this period where we're waiting, and I don't think the vendors are going to do it. So in order to make this real computing revolution happen in our lifetimes, we're going to have to do it ourselves. And I think the open source community is going to have to do most of it. So next slide. Okay, so why does it take so long? Well, it's because we live in little hermetically sealed containers that contain beliefs that we've forgotten that we know. Those McLuhan was referring to us as the fish, and the water is our context or beliefs that we don't know we're in, but govern our lives. So another way of thinking about this is to take that water and flatten it out into a plane, and consider our thought to be like an ant wandering over it. And the ant can have all kinds of illusions. The ant can have the illusion of a goal, and the ant can do problem solving and get around the goal, get around obstacles that are between it and the goal. Everything the ant is doing is pink, though. Doesn't realize it. But every once in a while, the ant gets a little blue idea, a little outlaw idea. But, go ahead, Mike. So the ant goes to church. The ant has parents. The ant goes to school. And in fact, this is a great first-order theory for human beings as a subsistence society. You can't afford too many experiments when you're just barely making it. So I believe this is built into our nervous systems that there are many mechanisms which force our little outlaw thoughts out of our minds and have us be nice and conforming with the pink thoughts of our society. Go to the next. But every once in a while, when we're waking up in the morning or taking a shower or out for a run, one of these blue thoughts bursts through. We get a kerpow instead of a kersplat. And the technical term for one of these is called holy shit. Now, one of the problems with ideas is that all ideas, even these blue ideas, virtually all of them are mediocre down to bad. If you think about it, you can understand why most ideas are bound to be bad, or at least mediocre. So it's very important to investigate these ideas. In the old days, when somebody had one of these big blue ideas, because they feel like they come from heaven. In the old days, people would go out and start a religion when they had one of these ideas. And in fact, they still do today. So you have to be careful. So go to the next. So now if we look at barriers for this, one of them is this compartmentalization that's signified by the goldfish bowl. Another one is case-based reasoning, which is also built into us. So our legal system today is case-based. Engineering started off as being case-based and is still rather case-based today. Computer science is very case-based. But in fact, science started becoming principle-based and model-based. The Greeks tried to dispense with the case-based form of mathematics that the Babylonians and the Egyptians used by coming up with a model and theory-based way of doing reasoning. Now, case-based reasoning has the problem that often there are so many cases that you can have cases that are quite contradictory, like you often find in religious tracts. And so when you're doing case-based reasoning, you can just find the case that you like rather than actually thinking things through. So another huge barrier is instrumental reasoning. And instrumental reasoning is being so in love with the goal that you're working on that any new idea you're presented with is judged solely on whether it contributes to the goal you're on right now. So hit next there, Mike. And so instrumental reasoning essentially draws a kind of a barrier around the short-term goals that you're working on and causes you even to reject good pink ideas that are around. And it certainly causes you to reject blue ideas. So the American business particularly is full of instrumental reasoners. This is one of their biggest problems, is they find it impossible to transform themselves when presented with a new idea. into a new way of thinking about things. So next. So here's an interesting way of looking at the spread of ideas. So the blue things in there are people whose minds are almost ready to be made up. So there's about 10% of them in this little particle simulation. So if Mark hits start there, you can see almost nothing happens there on the right-hand side. So now try 50% there, Mike, in the slider. And say start over. Now about half of them are blue, and we can see, amazingly, even with half of the people almost ready to make up their minds, I've tried 60%. So I think this is what happens with new ideas, is that people have great ideas all the time, and when they try to communicate them out, generally early on there's only a small percentage of people who are halfway ready to accept the idea. And there has to be many, in out in society, there have to be many, many versions of this idea floating around sort of late, in a latent form, until finally there's enough people when the next articulation of the idea happens, it will spread. Now sometimes this can be, what gets spread is a watered down version of the idea. So for example, the web is a very watered down version of the idea compared to what Engelbart was thinking about. It was basically just magazine pages with a few hyperlinks. And the people who did the browsers did not even think to allow you to author through the browser. And this was done long after personal computers around with symmetric authoring and consumption. So the people who were thinking about the web weren't thinking hard at all, and yet the world was ready for that little idea, and now it's established a whole bunch of really bad de facto standards that have to be fought every day. Same thing with firewalls. The firewalls are a terrible idea. They're basically the result of companies like Microsoft saying, well, we don't know how to invent locks or build sturdy houses, so the best you can do is put up a big wall and a moat around a whole village, and we'll just let the village perish when people climb the wall and get through the moat. And this is not the way to do it. The way to do protection is in object-to-object relationships, so that even if an object is breached, and it should take a lot of work to do that, you haven't breached any of the rest of the system. We all know this. This has been around since capability systems were invented in the 60s. And I believe part of the problem why we can't run our demo today is because of some goddamn firewall somewhere. Okay, next slide. So my belief here is that adults are basically hopeless, and the way to build up a lot of those little blue squares there of children that are ready for people who are ready to accept new ideas is to start working with children, work through a few generations of children, and get them to think in a much broader way with multiple perspectives than most adults do. So here's a non-computer example of just how well children can think in the right environment. So this is a first grade class in a school that we worked in about 15 years ago. And the first grade teacher was really unusual in that she was a natural mathematician. She was like that jazz musician friend of yours who never took a lesson but is a fantastic musician anyway. And she was that way with mathematics. She just saw things mathematically, and because her heart and soul was with teaching kindergarten and first grade, she did some of the most wonderful math curriculum I've ever seen for very young children. So take a look at this project. This is about 4 months along in first grade. She has the children pick a shape and then start making progressions of the next larger constructions of that particular shape. So in the upper right-hand corner are diamonds. So there's one diamond, then the next larger diamond you can make with diamonds, the next larger diamond you can make, and so forth. The lower right-hand corner is with trapezoids, and this requires a fair amount. Notice that Alesti probably was working on this one because it goes the other way. And the kid had to realize, oh, I have to rotate the trapezoids around in order to make the next larger sizes. So this one required some ingenuity to do. So they all do this individually. Then next, and then and the teacher treated mathematics as a kind of a science. So she'd have the kids do things with manipulables and then analyze them. These are six-year-old kids. So these are the projects that these six-year-old kids came up with. So they took their results with the solid pieces and put them into paper, and then they wrote a little table of what they did in order to get these next larger shapes. So you can see there that this is Lauren's table here, and you can see that the first one took one, and then the next one took three more, and the next one took five more, and the next one took seven more. And then the column on the right is the total number of tiles, which is a suspicious looking. In fact, both of those progressions are suspicious looking. And okay, go to the next one, Mike. And then they combined them all together, and they just went nuts. And that picture of me up in the upper left-hand corner doesn't show the tears running down my face, because what these children had done was discovered a generalization, which is a second-order differential equation growth law. Right? It's the one that makes the quadratic numbers. Go back. One more. Yeah. And the children couldn't think of it in terms of algebra. But the way these children can deal with generalizations is by essentially putting all the cases together as a collection of cases. So the way they thought about this is there are a lot of things that grow this way. That's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen very young children do, and it was the basis for a number of the other experiments that we've done over the years with computers. So go to the next slide. Okay, now you get to do your thing, Mike. So here's a typical project that we do with kids. Mike is going to draw a little car. Yeah, that's great. So that's a typical kid's car. As you say, keep, then it makes it into an object, and you can change the size of it, make it a little smaller there. Okay, you can look inside of it. I want you to call it car up there. And you can drag out some tiles there. So I want you to drag out the forward, makes a little script, drag out the turn, start it going. So what we've got there is basically Seymour Papert's circle script, but with costumes now. This appeals to many, many more. So this is differential geometry again, appeals to many more children. And they can indulge the fantasy of learning how to drive a car by going up and drawing a steering wheel. Okay? Now first, Mike, before you do anything with a steering wheel, why don't you start the car going again? And just show how you can move the car around. Go into the script and change the carrots on the turn 5. So run it down to 0. 0 goes straight, go negative. Okay. Move it. Submit. So you can steer the car by changing those numbers there. But it's more fun to do it with the wheel. So why don't you call that guy a wheel that you just drew? Okay. And the wheel's heading is where the wheel is pointing. So try dropping that into the script. Okay. And now see if you can steer the car with the wheel. So this is the way the children learn variables, but I just thought all of the programmers in the crowd would like to see the programming of the future, because shouldn't programming be like that? And in fact, if you know about some of the interactive languages in the 60s, we'll realize the programming of the future is actually the programming of the past, because there's no reason why you can't have an incremental compiler. These kid scripts actually run at the same power as Squeak's own scripts, and Mike can actually show you the Squeak that's underneath them there by clicking on the little square guy in the script. Not that guy. The little square thing to the left of the script, yeah. That's the small talk. It's basically the same as the script. Okay, click on it again to get rid of it. Okay, and in a late-bound system, every change can take about a quarter of a second or so, and you should never have to stop the system and build it from scratch. Okay, next slide. Okay, so the problem with the way children are taught today is they're taught a kind of a fake math, which is really calculation, and they're also taught a weak form of it. So scientists got rid of coordinate systems in any strong way by introducing vectors more than 100 years ago. And Newton even used them because his basic formulations in the Principia were geometric, and he shows the parallelogram rule for adding vectors in the very front part of the Principia. So all of this analytic geometry stuff is more of a snare and a delusion. So hit next there. Basically, the idea when we're teaching children is we teach them powerful mathematics of vectors and differential geometry and the science that goes along with it. Next slide. Okay, I think this is probably a good one to quit on, because this is a nice little program done by these two girls here. And the challenge was for them to figure out how to, not yet, Mike, the challenge was for them to figure out how to make a road and a car so that the car would go down the center of the road. And you can see their solution there. So the first conditional says only make the car go forward if it can sense the middle of the road. The other two say turn one way if you hit either curb. And notice that the car will only go forward if the sensor is on the middle of the road. So now let's try it, Mike. So notice it will stop here and negotiate this turn. So it can handle any turn. Okay, go to the next slide. Go to the next slide. So this is the little animation program. And the very same program, go ahead and start that. Works for movies. So this is so what is the model of a movie? Is you basically have a collection of the frames, and you increase the cursor by one each frame time, and you change the costume on the movie guy each frame time. So these are the semantics of showing all animated kinds of things, and even for doing professional movies, because you can run that, try, Mike, change that number to a 2. So you're changing this, change it to a 0.5. So that number is the rate of sampling. So you get all the speed controls. And so in the terms we used a long time ago, we would say the entropy of the programs for making movies is actually rather small. It's really just two little ideas. Next slide. Okay, let's just run those. So this is gradient following. Salmon follow a kind of a linear gradient, and clownfish follow circular gradients, basically the same program. One little piece of memory does it. Next slide. Okay, and here's how we do all this stuff. Start off with this nice stuff called CPU and memory. Okay, operating systems I'm not a big fan of, although I happen to like Linux. But the reason I don't like operating systems that much is that they tend to restrict what you can do. I like object-oriented systems better. And I like the Internet, too. Next part of this. And they have restrictions, too, particularly the World Wide Web. And the way we survive is by just touching the existing operating system. So all of the graphics and all the movies and all everything else we do is part of what travels along with Squeak, and it's machine and platform independent. So we run bit identically on almost 30 platforms now, from tiny little chips to big mainframes and even supercomputers. The Cray SV1 we run on, and we run on most of the vanilla systems in between. And we do the same thing with the internet. We have our own sockets, and we can run as a plug-in to a standard browser, but most of the time we don't want to. So if you think of the fact of the internet says that everything we do has to be able to run on every machine, and it has to be able to run on every machine rather quickly. And one of the things I love about Linux is that enormous amount of effort has been put into Linux in being able to port it relatively quickly. And Squeak works very, very well with Linux. Next slide. So here's something that we've been working on, which I'm not going to talk about because I only like to talk about stuff we can demo. But Mike and Jim might be able to demo this for you offline here. Is this problem of collaborative work being a 2 to the n problem, because of that's the number of subgroups there are in a network of n people. And 2 to the n is not a situation that's going to be solved by having servers to hold the shared state. So somehow there has to be a distributed peer-to-peer solution that only uses the computers that people bring to the party to solve this problem. And we have done a fair amount of work on this the last year and a half, and Mike can talk about it later if you want. Okay, let's go to the last slide. And this is just, don't do it yet, Mike. So this is just a plea for making systems smaller. So I believe that the smaller a system is, the easier it is to understand, the easier it is to maintain, the easier it is to change, the easier it is to get rid of. And so if we look at Squeak and we count all of the code in the system for its equivalent of an operating system, its equivalent of the applications you've seen, and many, many more apps that are in there. Go ahead, Mike. So Squeak is going to count it up here, and it comes to about 2.8 megabytes for all the code in the system. This is why this stuff worked at Xerox PARC. And this code could be a lot smaller. So the entropy of this code, we think, is somewhere between 10, it's about 230,000 lines of code. But we think the entropy of it is somewhere between 10,000 lines and 20,000 lines. So if this system were actually a factor of 10 smaller, it would be incredibly easier to understand, to change, and improve. That's some of the work that we're thinking about next year. So I think that's a good place to stop. And let me just encourage everybody to make the future be what it could be by taking some heart from some of these inspirations from the past. You can't go back to the past, but the inspirations can serve us to create a much, much better future than the vendor community is doing right now. Thanks a lot.
The question was, what should we do about software patents? I don't think Alan's a lawyer and I am either, but I don't like them.
What patents? No, what I mean is that this is one of the interesting fact. There's one company I know of in Silicon Valley that has five Altos running connected to a modern file server just to deal with prior art. The problem is most patents are based on, you know, I think weak ideas that people have had recently. And so there's an enormous amount of prior art and plenty of evidence about this prior art to deal with this. The Patent Office in America has given up on adjudicating patents. So they're just awarding patents and leaving it up to the civil courts. So this is really bad. And we need to fight that, maybe along the lines of Larry Lessing. But we need to fight it in every way. And I personally don't think we should be that proud of our code right now to try and patent it. But in any case, I believe that many things that are going to be counted as improvements in the next 5 to 10 years were already demonstrated 35 years ago, and there's a movie and a paper about it somewhere. So it's like, don't worry about, you know, I don't know whether graffiti is patented or not, but the recognizer done it at RAND was a better one. And there was a paper written on it in 1966, and there was a great movie that I extracted there that showed that. I think even HP has some patents on page turning with using a little touchpad. You stroke it, and the page turns, and the page animates. I've got a great movie of Nicholas Negroponte's people in the 70s that did exactly the same thing. In fact, they built a chair. They had an Eames chair with page-turning pads in the arms. They used anti-aliased fonts, and they animated the page turns. So as long as the people of my age don't die off yet, we still remember all of these old systems from the past, so we don't worry about those patents.
I guess I have one quick comment to add to that, which is just that I've seen in this community when people check, they only check the web, and guess what? The web hasn't been around very long. So you should also, when you want to know what things are out there that might be interesting, you talk to some of those old folks.
Yeah. Send email. The Computer Museum in San Jose, Moffett Field, Ames, that area in Silicon Valley there has an incredible compendium of old papers and old movies. I mean, I've got like 12,000 manuscripts of papers that I've collected over the years and stuff. And there's a lot of prior art around. And it doesn't bother me that much because I'm still interested in finishing this invention of personal computing, which I don't think is finished yet. And I don't think the computer revolution has happened yet. So we have to make it happen for everyone in a way that is very, very different than the way today's computer scientists and programmers think of computing. And the ideas about how to do this are very, very old, much older than any patents that could possibly have been made on this stuff. The hard thing is making it work.
I think we have to stop here. Thank you all
very much. Great. Well, thanks. Thank you, Jim, for and thank you, Michael, for being a very intelligent agent.
Firewalls are very evil things.